You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. We're here with Colonel Duffy White, United States Marine Corps, retired. Our battle study is about the march up and the role that First Light Armored Reconnaissance played in the march up. And at the time, Duffy was the battalion commander. What was your call sign? Highlander 6?
That was Highlander 6.
Oh, my God.
Absolutely.
Mel Gibson had nothing on you. All right, so, you know, again, I just want to echo something I said a little bit ago. You know, it makes me almost laugh when, you know, he says, and we turn the whole thing around. That's impossible to do, okay? That's impossible to do. And then to try to get the right guys back in front and the order of movement ready and get guys going. You talk about shit shows, you know, and people screaming and yelling and moving and directing traffic and stuff. That's the only way it gets done. But you say these things, the reality of there's one road, we're not going to turn around on it and go back. You're just like, you got to be kidding me. You got to be kidding me. So anyway, so keep going, Duff. You guys are now moved over, moving in the process of moved over to Highway 6 south of Baghdad, and you guys are headed north.
Yeah, I finally found Colonel Dunford up in his forward jump CP, and we talked with him, and he had given me my order. So me and my opso, great Marine Byron Harper, we were coming back to our vehicles as 3-5 was still in the fight, and for the best that we could hear from the radio, I mean, we could hear the fight going on, but, you know, there were guys, literally, Iraqis that wanted to get the jihad on, they were at one point driving them in buses, and 3-5 was shooting busloads full of these guys with weapons hanging out the window shooting at them. When they first attacked, one of the rifle companies, the Amtrak, you know, they were mecked up going down, and they, you know, get a kind of a near ambush, near contact. And so the immediate action of the Amtrakers is, they said they, you know, turn into the fire and go off the road, kind of, you know, just, no kidding. Hey, they're fire from the left. Let's turn to the left and the bad guys were in so close to the Amtraks, ran past the bad guys, and as they dropped the ramps for the grunts to go out, they were like shooting at each other right there, you know, right as the ramp was coming down, that's where the bad guys were. And,
wow.
You know, not, you know, none of the guys in 3-5 were killed in that, but, you know, just that kind of, just real close in stuff going on. And, you know, Byron and I were, you know, kind of getting our stuff together because I'm going to have to call the order, and Byron's going to have to call the order all the way back, you know, to the rest of the battalion as it's still picking its way through RCT5.
Okay. So hey,
we are going to
let me stop and ask you. So when you say call the order, what does that mean? When you're going to, are you going to give this order, over the radio?
How you
can transmit it? Okay.
It's all radio, and luckily, you know, where we were, we could get a lot of face-to-face orders from General, or from Colonel Dunford, but, you know, that's, you know, it was kind of to me and the lead battalion a lot of times, but he would give, no kidding, you know, fragos over the regimental attack net, and they have time of execution now, time now. And so as you're thinking all the stuff you have to do, you know, me and the opso would have to be formulating our order, and then we would have to get all of our company collective call signs up to then issue the order as literally it was, we're already moving. And, it was the most fluid, you know, potentially complex and dangerous thing. But at that point, you know, all of the rehearsals we had done in Kuwait and just understanding, and I tell you, if you, you know, we used to give five paragraph order tests at the, at the basic school, and every order Colonel Dunford gave was literally right from his head. I don't think he ever wrote any of them down, and it was textbook perfect every time. You could clearly, you know, visualize what he wanted to do. If you just close your eyes and listen to the words, you're like, okay, this is what the way we're going to maneuver. The guy was really a master at that. And made it a lot easier for us because there wasn't a lot of conflicting word, you know, and then his OPSO and XO would reinforce, you know, what he wanted. So that kept a lot of the internal RCT friction down.
Got it.
To a minimum. But literally, you know, we're sitting there kind of formulating the plan, and we had no idea we'd park right next to an artillery battery that was right off the road, and they lit off, and we, you know, the danger arc is in front of the barrels, like the area echo or whatever. I swear we were underneath it. It lifted us off the ground. We had no idea that they were that close. It was that dark. And we're like, oh my God. You know, if I didn't get a concussion from that, I don't think I've got too hard a hit. I won't ever get a concussion. But,
now you're talking, you know, you're talking about good guy artillery, yes?
Yeah, good guy artillery. Okay. You know, whatever the lead battalion, the Artie battalion was that was supporting 3-5, it had been 211. Good God, I had no idea we were that close. And so, all right, now it's the night's going on, the battalion's moved up through, and, you know, all right, Colonel Douglas says, you know, first of all, keep going. So we're going to continue the attack, and there's, I don't know if you can see in map number 3, we're kind of almost to Baghdad now, and you see a little blue river that runs north to south just to the east of Baghdad called the Diyala River. That's kind of where we're aiming at this point. And there's a road.
Okay, which map is it? Map number, it's our map number map, 3, right?
Map number 3 is the one that calls Isolation of Baghdad.
Got it.
29 March to 7 April.
Okay, and what are we looking at? Okay.
We're looking for, you find Baghdad and you look at the, they've got the 1MEF, 5 Corps boundaries jacked up. 1MEF is to the east. So we're north of the Tigris. That's the trace of those blue arrows. See that little number 9 up there?
Got it. Yep.
Yeah, that's kind of us. Those blue arrows going towards Baghdad. And if you look almost at the point of the area, you see the 1st Marine Division mecked up symbol. You'll see the Diyala River right there. And that's Highway 6, and there's a road that runs parallel on the east side of the Diyala River. And that was our mission. We were going to go up and find a crossing along the Diyala River that we could get RCT-5 and then the rest of the division across without having to fight through the built-up area in the bridges across the highway. That was the initial plan. Because our mission, remember, we're 1st Marine Division is the supporting attack. The main effort is the 3rd Infantry Division, the Army, to the south that's coming up through the Karbala Gap and Halal, and, you know, they've already gone through Najaf. And it was funny. We were listening to BBC, and Gunnar Musselman and I were, and he picked up what was the crazy spokesman, Baghdad Bob or whatever they called him.
Right.
They said, he was like, we have defeated the U.S. Army at the Saddam airport. They are turning and they're running and they're in flames and they're dead. You know, we're going to defeat the infidels, you know, kind of stuff like that. We're like, holy crap. I fired up that blue force tractor and looked and there was nothing but U.S. Army icons all over the airport. Like, I think that guy's lying, but it was pretty funny, you know, cause, you know, had we not had that, we would have no idea what was going on with the Army.
Good thing. good thing you don't get your news in Baghdad Bob.
Exactly. Yeah. So we take the lead. It's pre-dawn and, you know, we're, you know, hey man, buckle your chin straps, man. We're going to hit it.
Duff, you're still, though, expecting from the division, you're still getting, hey, if the red line isn't someplace near here, then it's never gonna happen.
Yeah, and really, it was exactly. We thought that the Kim, and we had no reason to believe he didn't, that he was going to use it in the last ditch effort. And that was part of the reason he didn't want to go straight up the most likely avenue of approach. You know, where you have a whole division stacked up on the road, that's right. Probably where you're most. Even they could get the target reference points right.
Mass some
fires there. So, you know, we really did want to find a crossing, that would give us a little bit of different look than probably what they were expecting us to give them. And, so I'm like, all right, boys, you know, let's go. And they had trenches they had dug along the side. They'd put fuel in there. Flame trench, flame burning, you know, it's kind of washing out your night vision goggles and all that stuff. And, you know, we drive right through, make the right turn, heading north up that road, and there was nothing. The enemy had faded away, for that night. And, we get to a certain point, and then the rest of RCT5 kind of catches up. And then, We first LAR start finding in earnest then, send companies all the way along the river to start reconning possible, river crossing points.
Okay.
And I had one of my companies go all the way north to our, division limit of advance. And it was, we found out they had the MEF still wanted to have an aviation kill box open. They didn't want to change that because it basically was a free fire area. But, that company that was up there started making contact with, it was the first time they had seen Iraqi army units. And, one of our companies, shot with a tow across the river. We kind of had some high ground on our side, shot across and killed a moving T-72 tank. And one of our other companies winds up getting engaged in close, and the 25 millimeter, as they were returning fire, went a little long and lit off an ammo dump. And Mac, it sounded like a volcano erupting, and I was a couple of clicks away. And the company commander was like, hey, we're getting the hell away from this thing. Because, I mean, it was just so literally, we had all these kind of, it wasn't a concerted enemy action, but all these little independent contacts going on. And third LAR is screening to our east, so further away from the river than we are. And, cobras coming in off of East Coast Mew. They almost did a blue on blue, so they, literally were shooting at third LAR's cobras, LABs with their cobras. We had a Navy F-18 drop a 500 pounder right between two of our vehicles, blew out the tires, gave some guys concussions and stuff like that, but thank God it didn't hit what it was dropping out. So, I mean, it was a lot of little stuff, and on the other side of the river, there was an Iraqi military symbol on the map. And we had kind of learned that if we were going to see any activity, it would be nearby. Those kind of things was a likely expectation. And we had a section of Hueys flying in support of us. And our air officer was coordinating with the lead company, FAC, who said, hey, can you get them across the river to check that out to see what it is, because if we cross the river, we'd like to know what's on the other side before we're swimming those awesome LAVs across the dang river, and,
hey, Duff, can you describe the Diala River?
It was, where, and I can find a couple of pictures of it. They wound up we wound up building a bridge nearby there and getting some guys across later. But, basically it was probably 200 meters wide. Problem, Mac, and as we discovered that day and the next day, was there was no infrastructure, roads to support moving that many vehicles, that much tonnage up and around. The river, I think, was doable, and we found some viable crossing points, but for like an LAR battalion or an Amtrak battalion, but there was no way we could get everything. It would have been, you know, like a, you know, it would have taken forever to get the whole division across.
Now, had they blown all the bridges that had been in existence? Had they blown those bridges?
We didn't see any bridges on the Diala, and we didn't know what the main bridge is like off of Highway 6 into Baghdad, or at least I didn't know.
Okay.
Of what they were like. So, you know, we thought the fate of the division's mission and the speed was up to us to find a crossing.
Right.
And Colonel Dunford came up and he's like, "Hey, show me your best locations." You know, we're driving. He's like, "Man, these roads are trash. There's no way. We physically can't do it." And I'm like, I got to agree with you, sir. You know, and as it turns out, you know, that's when RCT-1 actually took the lead and actually forced the crossing over the bridges, RCT-1 and RCT-7. And then we wound up going in behind them. But that's a couple of days later. Doing all the actions that first day along the Diala River and the section of Hueys are flying for us, they start taking fire from that Iraqi military position across the river. And Gunner Musselman goes, "Hey, sir, look." And one of the Hueys is leaking fuel big time. And it's flying kind of directly in front of us across our frontage. And it kind of loops around real quick and lands probably 200, 300 meters away from our vehicle, literally. And the crew, they jump out, and there's fuel pouring out of the back where the troop area is. And they got shovels, and they start digging a trench away from the helicopter. And we look, and there's Ollie North. He jumps out. And he'd been a passenger in that section of Hueys, and they went and did one pass, and they got some shots at him, and they did a second pass and wound up getting shot and severed a fuel line. And, so we went over there, and the pilot, you know, he was like, "Sir, thank you for being here. Can you call, you got long haul comms, so we can call back and get the right parts to get us fixed. And can you stay until we get fixed?" You know, and we're like, "Yeah, we are not going to abandon you here." So we, you know, and luckily, you know, all that happened in time. But, you know, I was talking to Colonel North. I'm like, "Hey, sir, how was it?" He goes, "To be honest with you, once we got shot, we really, I didn't know if we were going to land on the enemy side of the river or the friendly side. We thought we were on the friendly side, and I'm glad to find out we were," you know, so. But I asked the crew chief, "Hey, how was Colonel North and all that?" He said, "He was great. The only question he asked was, 'Hey, do you know how to ground mount this 50 cal in case we got a fight when we land?'" And so, you know, we're there, we're trying to find, crossings, and it just doesn't happen, Mac. And as it turns out, then, they forced the bridges on Highway 6. They had not been blown. And basically, RCT-5 then pulls in behind, and the battalions, the infantry battalions, go in first, and we come in last, and then we do a relief in place with, the three infantry battalions, basically with one of my companies replacing the infantry battalion. And then for the next several days, Colonel Dunford was sending in like 1-5 and these deep penetration attacks into Baghdad. And they were getting into hellacious fights. And all these, you know, I think, you know, there were some unique things. We had
okay. Let me just kind of identify where you're at on the map. So you cross the Diyala River at Highway 6, right? And then once you get across the river, where do you go? Do you essentially continue to move up Highway 6,
there were a couple of key roads on that northeast section of Baghdad. There were a couple of canals and a couple of river crossings. So that was key terrain, and that's kind of where the infantry battalions went to, and that's where we then replaced them. That was our mission, was present a credible threat to the Saddam regime from the northeast. Now, that was 1st Marine Division supporting attack mission. And we wound up, as we were going through, used to be called Saddam City. Sadr City was Saddam City. He hated Sadr and his father so bad, he renamed it after himself. He renamed it Saddam City. And so, I mean, we were crossing through there, and we'd gotten word that the CIA or somebody had basically told those guys to stand down. We're not going to mess with them if they don't mess with us. We're just passing through to establish these security spots. And, it was a fascinating time. We're getting all sorts of prisoners and things like that. Once we got in there, we probably had, I don't want to overestimate, but it almost 10 different Iraqis come grab our Marines and wind up, coming back to the battalion CP of, hey, we'll show you where the chemical weapons are. What are you talking about? Through the interpreters and interviewing them and stuff. The Iraqi army at some point would come into their neighborhood and impress them all into service and have them dig these big holes to bury stuff in and things like that. So even at that point, we still thought there were chemical weapons. And that we were going to find them. I mean, here are all these Iraqis coming up unsolicited. It wasn't like we were saying, hey, have you seen any, chemical weapons around or anything? So it was an interesting time. And there were, probably after the second day there, the Iraqis started returning to Baghdad. And I swear, Mac, every third Iraqi had a better car than I've ever driven in my life. They had BMWs, Mercedes. They were all coming back in. They were honking. Old ladies kissing the Marines on the cheek, baking bread and stuff, And they'd all like, hey, where's Saddam? I'm like, you tell me, I'll go get him, It was one of the companies were going kind of on a recon down these main highways out of the city, and they're reporting like it was like Mardi Gras, New Year's Eve, parades, all in one, just the joy of the people, because we were there, it was pretty interesting actually. That's kind of where that fight ends. I know we don't want to go that far.
Okay. Well, no, we can stop there. Let me just ask you some questions about that. Okay. Yeah. So, where are you when the Amtraks pull the statue of Saddam down? Are you anywhere?
Yeah.
Are you anywhere near?
We were nearby. We were in those company, strong points. And I forget which unit that was. We had no idea that it happened, actually. At one point, when we were going up Highway 6, one of the second tank, gunners had shot a statue of Saddam, and it blew his head off. And one of our companies snagged that thing. It was a big metal head. The head. It was probably like big as a dang 80-inch flat screen TV. We had that roped across the top of a vehicle, and I had no idea what the hell happened to it, but we wanted that thing.
Let me tell you, if you've been around the Marine Corps, one of the things when we were lieutenants in Okinawa, you'd be walking around Camp Hansen, right, and you have different things that they brought back from Vietnam. Right?
Yeah.
And if you're back at the CPs in Camp Pendleton, you'd see things, you know, pretty rare. If you were in 5th Marines, you saw them from, you know, from France. And you're, so we're no stranger to a good trophy. Okay? And that head,
yeah,
that head would have been a good one.
Oh, it was an awesome one. You know, he had some, like, you know, Arab chieftain headdress kind of thing on, if I remember right. It was pretty awesome, actually.
Hey,
we wound up. Go ahead.
Well, let me just say, so if we paint a picture for everybody, so you're across the Diala River, you're in company strong points. How is the division? And is your left lateral limit the Tigris River? Do you have anybody? Does the division have anybody on its left?
Yeah, the Army was to the south. Basically, that's a good way to describe it. If I remember right, we had the Tigris to the north and east, and they had the Tigris, you know, inclusive to the south and west.
Got it.
And basically, you say they had the larger line share of the city.
Got it.
You know, and literally, you know, that's what we were doing. You know, Colonel Bunford was just sending the battalions in. And in fact, I was going to say, I don't know how many Marines were saved by not having enough room inside vehicles to store all their packs and stuff.
Right.
So everybody had them shackled on the outside. And those Alice packs are, I guess we had Molly gear then, I'm not sure. They could absorb an RPG and keep it from penetrating a vehicle.
Right, another layer.
And,
another layer of armor.
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing. And, especially the one attack 1-5 had. I mean, I was there talking with Colonel Dunford, and they had gone in, and Saddam must have been there because they were fighting, the Iraqis were fighting like tigers. And, you know, the whole battalion was necked up getting shot at, and not one Marine was killed. And at one point, they said the battalion is almost out of ammo. So they had to run a battalion ammo resupply at night, to keep fighting. I mean, I can't even imagine how many rounds 1-5 fired at those guys, and not one Marine was killed.
And
I guarantee you that was a different score on the other side, you know.
Well, you know, that was always a telltale sign when you bumped in, when all of a sudden they fought like they didn't normally fight. You tended not to know what you ran into, at least, you know, afterwards when I was there, but you bumped into somebody who they were fighting for, which is pretty atypical. I don't want to go into this, but you guys, tell us about very generally, you guys then went up to Tikrit under the command of General Kelly.
Yeah, real quick, thumbnail sketch. Your listeners hopefully will remember that the big plan, war plan, called for a northern front to be opened up from Army units, 4th Infantry Division, attacking through Turkey up into the kind of Kurdish area up north, Mosul, Erbil, Kirkuk, all them, and coming down and kind of meeting in Baghdad. Well, geopolitics got in the way, that didn't happen. So 4th ID had to sail around all the way to do an admin offload in Kuwait. So as it was, 3rd ID was, you know, in their half of Baghdad. 1st Marine Division was in, you know, our half of Baghdad. And the story that I got relayed to me was the C-Flick, you know, Corps commander called down to the Marine planners and said, "Hey, General Conway, General Mattis, do you think you could attack Tikrit?" And, I think Conway asked Mattis, "Can you do it?" And Mattis was like, "Yeah." And they're like, "Well, how soon could you do it?" And he goes, "God, I didn't want him to take that mission away from me." So I said, 24 hours. And some of, I think Paul Kennedy and a couple of our other planners that were talking to the Army guys, they were like, "Those bastards, those Marines, We knew they were going to say that. And so literally, we're in these strong points, and I get a call, hey, you be at the division CP at this bombed out building in Baghdad at like 7 a.m. and have your whole battalion moving to an assembly area northeast of the city by noon. Be prepared to receive an order for follow on tasking. And, it wasn't until we got to that meeting. Gosh, the MAR 4 commander was there, General Hailston, everybody was there, and there wasn't much congratulations going on because they're like, hey, we're forming a task force with the division, basically Bravo Command Group. The assistant division commander, General Kelly, is going to be the commander, and it's going to be the 3 active duty, light armored recon battalions and, an artillery battalion, 511. And basically, you guys are attacking and you're going to seize to crit. And so that's what we did. That next day, it was that same day. We get to the assembly area.
Okay, hold on now. Are you still in MOP 3? Because
I think we had come out of MOP. Well, I don't know. We still might have been in MOP 3.
All right. Because Gunner, 2 days ago was talking about the day he burned his MOP suit. It was a pretty good day. Do you remember? Do you recall seeing him burn his MOP suit?
Yeah, it didn't burn very good. It stunk. It's that charcoal. But, I mean, those were like second sets of skin at that point for us all.
Wow.
And it was starting to warm up then. It was cold in Kuwait when we were there in January, February, and beginning of March. But it was starting to warm up. So I was glad we got out of those things. But as it turns out, we get the order and we go in the attack that night. Move all night and attack and seize to crit. It was at one point, Mac, just not bragging or anything, but first General Kelly made me the chief of police of Tikrit, and then all these sheikhs and other town leaders were just bothering the heck out of him. He's like, forget this. Hey, Duffy, you're now the mayor. And so he made me the – so I've got that going for me. So he made me the mayor
of Tikrit. Do you put that on your resume?
I should. But it was awesome, actually. One highlight for me personally was I want to say it was the French embassy had gotten word to the Americans that they knew that Saddam had been killed in one of the earlier attacks. And that he was buried up in his hometown right outside of Tikrit. And they gave, something crazy, like a 10-digit grid coordinate for it. And so as we kind of pushed through and uncovered that area, General Kelly's like, hey, Duffy, let's go over. And literally, it was me and my wingman and our, four vehicles and his Humvee. And we go and we're hopping over fences and looking into people's backyards and stuff. There was nobody in the town. They had all left. So it was kind of eerie, but, he had not been killed and we didn't find his grave, but that would have been pretty cool if we had.
It would have been.
Okay.
Talk to us about, so the bottom line is I'm pretty short order. All 3 LAR battalions under General Kelly's command, moved north, to Tikrit.
Yeah.
All right, and did you encounter, you show up in Tikrit, and what happened? Was there any fighting that went on? Was there much?
Actually, it was pretty interesting. The intel brief that we were given was there could be as many as 20,000 hardcore Iraqi fighters. They're the most well-equipped, well-trained of all the Iraqi army. Or there could be nobody. I mean, literally, it was a pretty big variable there. And as we got going, it turned out that the Army wasn't using any of the fixed wing air, and nobody, none of the other Marine units were. So as my air officer told me, you know, we had a stack of casts that, you know, was a, you know, an aviator's dream. And, the rules of engagement were such if there were any viable military targets, you know, they could and identify them and shoot them from the air. You know, so my air officer was kind of running all that along with the task force, Tripoli air officer. So I want to say we ran like 80 sorties of air, you know, reports like, hey, they've got a company of, you know, tanks moving up here. Can we kill them? Roger? You know, so all that stuff, you know, was going on. And, we get to the outskirts and we stop, and we're in contact, literally broad daylight. My, it's the main road, goes into the city. And what we were going to do was 3rd LAR had led all the way up to Samara. And then we passed through them and continue the attack to the outskirts of the town. And then we were going to stop, you know, get a kind of an anchor point and, 2nd LAR under Lieutenant Colonel Eddie Ray, the Navy Cross recipient from the 1st Gulf War as a battalion commander. He led his battalion around the city to secure it from the northwest. So we had it kind of bottled up, if you will. And then 3rd LAR was going to come in and tie in with 1st to our left. And so we would have the entire city encircled, you know, tied into the river on either side. So we've got basically a half moon around the city. And then our mission was then that next morning to attack and seize the city center. And as we're getting there, we're pulling up, we're blocking the road. We're getting all sorts of contact with guys. I'm talking to the company commander. He's like, hey, sir, you know, we've got some insurgents, we got some Iraqis attacking us. And I'm like, what are y'all doing? Like, we're killing them, sir. Like, oh, Roger, you know, continue. And they were charging, you know, on foot towards LAVs, you know, in the open. And, at one point, one of my company commanders wound up chasing this one guy, trying to take him prisoner, and he wound up shooting him with his pistol because he wouldn't come out of this culvert. And he kept saying, I've got a bomb, I'm going to blow you up, I'm going to blow you up. And, you know, so we wound up shooting him. And we were finding, the bodies that we could search had all sorts of foreign passports, Jordanian, you know, whatever.
Right.
And they had, no kidding, been stamped into Iraq, you know, at the western border, you know, border crossing points. But there were all sorts of people that were going to, you know, fight us. So like, okay, you know, bring it on. And actually my opso, Byron Harper, said, let's see if we can fly over the city center and see what's going on. So we requested some Hueys and they landed. We were just about to get in and one of the pilot was a guy we had taught at the basic school. He was in Boomer Milstead's company. And we're talking and we're going to go up and fly. And, I get the word like, hey, you got to go, see, you know, General Kelly back at CP. So Byron Harper was going to go up and do the recon. So I was going to have to drive back to see General Kelly. He was going to do the recon and they hadn't gotten, you know, 5 minutes and I see him coming back and they're like, holy crap. They got all sorts of heavy machine guns and crap up there. So they're like, oh, we've seen enough. Let's go back. And you know, it was really interesting that the way the whole thing, you know, played out. But, a lot of those guys that we were fighting that first day and into that night and decided to go ahead and leave the area. Because when we did attack in, we kind of took this long route around a lot of the palaces. There were probably 30 palaces. I mean, big, you know, looked like European villa estate kind of things built along this high ground and along these man-made lakes and by the river. That was kind of where we cut through into the city center. And the main bridge had been bombed, but it, it was like passable in one lane. And so the city was virtually deserted. But, you know, as we were clearing through, like one of my companies, came across this lone Iraqi security guy at this military hospital. And basically he surrendered the hospital to the company and guided him in to where, Mac, I'm not lying, there had to be 80,000 rifles. A lot of them brand new, still in the box, wrapped in cosmoline. And some of them were loose. I mean, thousands of them were loose. And, you know, so the Iraqis were storing. And we, I mean, as we were going through, you know, there, here'd be an anti-aircraft weapon right next to somebody's house. You know, here was, you know, they had no problem, you know, kind of causing us to want to, you know, bomb in and amongst the civilians. But, you know, they're hiding your weapons in the hospitals and things like that. And, you know, we tell General Kelly that, and he comes over and looks at it and like, hey, this might be the small arms for, the new Iraqi army. So we got a bunch of folks from FSSG finally came up and they dug a huge pit, to destroy all the loose rifles, and they were loading out all the cases of rifles, but they started, you know, dug a huge pit and they would dump the rifles in with a tractor, and then they would light it on fire, and they would drive over, crush them all, put the next layer in, and do the same thing. And that thing was going for 48 hours, just destroying those weapons.
Wow.
It was crazy. Yeah. And we, you know, we wound up, we were meeting the leaders, doing all these engagements and doing all sorts of stuff, you know, trying to recruit, you know, we were recruiting a police force, we were trying to reestablish this, you know, basic services, and slowly people started coming back. And then we did a relief in place with Fourth ID. And that pretty much ended our mission. And we went, moved from there all the way back to Antigua Neewa to the division assembly area. And then we did get the band back together, and they did, you know, General Mattis gave Task Force Tripoli one more mission to go down and do a screen line for several days along the Saudi border, Saudi Kuwait border, because we got reports of Wahhabis infiltrating. And still remember General Mattis saying, looking at me and Stacey Clary, said, "I've always hated Wahhabis. I hated Wahhabis before it was cool." And we're going to go down here and find them.
Now, Task Force Tripoli is?
Is the LAR.
Regiment.
Battalion.
The LAR Regiment.
Yeah, exactly. And as it turns out, General Mattis wound up putting Colonel Dunford in charge of that, the second Tripoli. But it was an incredibly, you know, interesting experience, and, you know, a lot of...
No, I mean, it's hard even doing this stuff because... there's so many different things that you could blow up. I mean, we could do this for another 3 hours. Let's talk about lessons learned, if you don't mind.
Okay.
When you think back, as a leader, to the preparation that went in, to the execution, to the difficulty of executing, in the environment that you guys went into, expecting, you know, in mop suits, you know, going up one road, having to turn around and go back, you know, unknown situation with the enemy, movement to contact, constantly adjusting every day. Let's talk about, you know, lessons learned, hard lessons learned. And if you don't mind, if we could do it, for leaders. So give me a couple lessons learned for NCOs. Give me a couple lessons learned for company grade officers and staff NCOs. And then give me a couple lessons learned for battalion staff. So start with NCOs. If somebody asks you, hey, based on your experience, you know, what were your chief lessons learned for NCOs?
for an LAR NCO, and I'm sure it carries over to the other MOSs, almost every one of our sergeants were vehicle commanders. And so even though you might only have six or seven guys you're in charge of, you might also have a wingman, and you have to maintain that larger wing. You cannot kind of get down inside yourself and only worry about putting one foot in front of the other, because everything would break down. You have to understand and conceptualize what the platoon and the company and the battalion are doing. And, it really is challenging. By that point, I think anybody that couldn't do that and really, act independently based on your own judgment, but in concert with the overall mission and intent. And I know that sounds like a bunch of bullshit Quantico buzzwords, but it really is. You can't be successful and do the movement maneuver in that environment or in any LAR environment without the ability to do that and make that, have that, we talked about the bias for action and knowing that what you're doing, but it's all tempered with that really iron discipline that we had talked about, that brilliance in the basics. Is that guy is the master of that vehicle, and he makes it run, and it's almost like the old cavalry mindset. It's a, you got to take care of your horse, you got to take care of your weapon, then you got to take care of the trooper. And because if you don't have your horse, you don't have your weapon, you're useless. And if you throw in the communications in there as well, I think it really was a lot to put on. Hell, I was confused half the time, and for those guys to be able to get just a glimmer of a mission and an intent and see what that was supposed to be and take action, that fit with what we were doing was really, I think, a key for them. I will tell you, there was one sad story. I told you that we were getting new Marines in, anytime they would get replacements, we would send them up. Well, General Mattis had bought all of us burglar tools, we called them. What do you call the things where you got the big hook on the end of the rope and you throw it, grappling hook.
Right.
To pull wire and potential trip wires and things like that, and big crowbars and things like that. Well, when we got into Tikrit that first day, there were some buildings off, and the companies were going to go clear the buildings to make sure there wasn't any bad guys in there. And, one of these brand new Marines, it had a big padlock. And so instead of going back, instead of the NCO making him go back to the vehicle and get the damn crowbar, he just puts his rifle up there like you see on the TV. Shoots the lock, and the leg comes splatters in the eye, blinds him for life. One eye. Got a medevac. Boom. The war's over. And, you're like, God, it just, that 1 second where, he took action, he thought he was doing the right thing. I'm sure we didn't even have the level of iPro that we had later on in the fight there in Iraq and stuff like that, but I don't even know if that could have saved him, but just those kind of things, when it doesn't go right, there's an instant reinforcement. I think, unfortunately, in this situation, cost a young man his sight in one eye, I never saw him again. He was medevaced out. The junior officers, I think, in the LAR.
So let me go back to NCOs. Obviously, mastery of your craft, that vehicle, and your scouts, their scouting abilities, and understand, they had to know shit, understand the plan, and be able to operate. In the LAR community, they go a long ways. They have a lot of battle space. And it's not like you're gonna go through map sheets on a daily basis, you know. And so it's a different world. So mastery first, and then a conceptual understanding of what the task is at hand.
Yeah, or else if they don't have that, they're not gonna be effective. And the other thing that I will say is, it's not quite the General Krulak strategic corporal, but at any one point, especially in this fight, I saw that if you were the lead vehicle, whether you're in first LAR or third LAR, you know, 3-5, whichever, and you make contact, the entire fight depends on your actions and what you do initially to set the conditions for success in that engagement. And that's a lot. I mean, that really is a lot, I think. At least that's what I saw play out, because we were, you know, we were thousands of vehicles, but at some point it was that corporal or sergeant that was at the point of the entire RCT, you know, the lead unit of the whole division, that really, a lot was being asked of him, and you know, he delivered time and time again from what I saw.
But you know, Duff, it's what they sign up for. You know what I mean? It's what they sign up for, it's interesting when you the way you put it. But to me, it's interesting. At IOC, we used to do our debriefs like that. We would do one debrief about how did we execute techniques and procedures. Because we used to discuss, in order to be a factor on the battlefield, you got to be able to think, make decisions, and communicate. And then let's flip a switch and talk about, then you got to be an executing machine. So there is no discussion about, oh, I'm a thinker on the battlefield, or I'm an executor. You're both. But if you can't do both, you're irrelevant. And so to me, it's interesting the way you say that, because that's exactly how we used to talk about, you know, we talked about the conceptual part of combat, and then we talked about where the rubber meets the road, and that is, you can be Clausewitz all you want, but when you point them in that direction and say go, if they can't rip it, then you're nothing, and you got to be able to do both. And so interesting the way you say it. So obviously the same thing applies for company leadership. When you talk about company commanders, platoon commanders, and the company staff, lessons learned for those guys?
I think it's a lot of the similarities, because, you know, if it's a four vehicle platoon of LAV 25s, you know, you're a vehicle commander if you're the lieutenant, and, you know, you also have a wingman. And at some point, you know, you're doing those vehicle skills, vehicle craft, and all that kind of stuff. Now, the lieutenant, really does have to, you know, have a distinct awareness of where his other vehicles are and where they are in relation, where his platoon is in relation to the other platoons and the companies and the fire support coordination manager. Like you were saying, Mac, you know, we had, I want to say it was 1 to 100,000 map sheets. And a lot of we'd roll it out, Governor Muscle would roll it out, and there would be like one damn terrain line on the whole sheet. Like, oh, this is helpful. You know, and so just figuring out where you were and trying to just do the maneuver control measures just for commonality. Like, hey, you know, cause that was a big thing. Like, we're crossing phase line orange. Well, shit, where is phase line orange? You know, where's checkpoint 32? Where's all these other things? You know, so a lot of those things that seem simple that we train becomes very hard in that environment, in that operation. But with the absolute concern of there are distinct boundaries, and you don't want to cross a boundary and go into the Army section because you'll get lit up, I guarantee it. You know, you don't want to trip, the fire support, you know, coordination lines. You don't, you've got to know where you are and be able to bring all of those to bear. And we always would talk with the officers of, I learned that tankers don't even think, especially an Army tanker, don't even think about supporting arms. They're like, why would I need to do any supporting arms when I've got a 120 millimeter main gun? You know? And LAR, in my mind, and the way I would talk to my officers is, hey, the strength of the LAV itself is the actual, no kidding, strength of the armor is just enough so the turret doesn't crush the vehicle. This isn't going to protect you from shit. You got to use terrain. You got to understand terrain. You got to be able to see the terrain. And like, okay, where am I vulnerable? How could I, you know, it's like you're the center fielder. If I get the ball hit to me now, you know, is there a runner on second? Is there a runner on third? Do I go to the cutoff man? Is it, if it's deep, do I, you know, and you're doing that constantly because, you have to be able to do your immediate action, you know, establish a fighting position, return fire, seek cover, and then immediately start using supporting arms if you can't outright maneuver and destroy them. But at least you're going to start, you know, you're setting the base of fire with you and your wingman as you're deploying your other section, to gain advantage or flank on whoever's shooting at you.
But the truth is, and we know this is light armor reconnaissance guys, if you're relying on that 25 millimeter gun too much and not your supporting arms enough, it's only a question of time till you get engaged by something heavy enough to punch a bunch of holes in those things. And so there's an artistry. I don't say this because Duffy's here. I mean, I had two tours in light armored reconnaissance. There's an artistry, like being a cavalryman, that once you dismount and you lean on that rifle and you lose your ability to maneuver and you're now fixed, you're not heavy enough. For instance, the immediate action drill when a tank, an M1A1 or an M1A2, when the ammunition or it catches fire or the ammunition compartment starts to blow, the immediate action drill is close the hatches and you'll survive. Okay. That is not the immediate action drill in an LAV. Okay.
No.
It is not. That vehicle is good to move you. It's got a heavy enough gun, to lay waste to a lot of stuff. But if you get confused and think you're a tank, somebody's going to annihilate you and then you're going to get taught a hard lesson. So it's, and I think for that reason, and guys who understand it, the use of supporting arms, the use of terrain, your situational awareness all becomes heightened in a light unit, in a light armored unit, as opposed to those tankers, man. They're just pigs. I mean, those things are beasts. I mean, they're shooting things at 3,000 meters that can't even see them hardly. And they're killing them at 3,000 meters. And it's just, it's not a fair fight. And those things are rough. Light armor reconnaissance, not so much. And the demands for your company, so your point is the demands on the company officers and staff NCOs are pretty substantial relative to keeping your head in the game.
They are, and I kept, you know, all it takes, like, you know, you said, is just one ill-placed mine and the company commander gets blown up. You know, every one of those lieutenants have to be able to take over the company. Who's in the best position to take over? You know, it might not be the company XO in that position.
Right.
You know, because he'll be in the C square probably with the FAC or the FO, you know, so it might fall to that, you know, first platoon commander who has the best sight picture and understanding of what's going on right then and there, at least, you know, until they can figure things out. So to be able then to understand it, and that's what I would tell all the company commanders, like, you know, if we're no kidding in general support of the division, we have to understand the division, you know, scheme, maneuver, intent, you know, and then kind of telescope it down to what we can control, but you can't ever lose sight of that bigger picture, because next thing you know, we could be on the wrong side of the river, and now we've just ruined the whole RCT scheme of maneuver if we had gone too far or something like that. You know, it's it really is then, at that level, the company commander and XO and company gunny, especially in an LAR unit, his job is never done, because how are you keeping those vehicles up and operational? And he's with the recovery, variant, and they are, you know, they're fixing things on the fly. They're pushing fuel. They're pushing ammo. They're pushing chow. And, you know, that leaves the line platoons to do their thing while, you know, everybody else is, you know, getting the oats to the horse, you know, and, right, and water in your canteen, you know, so you can keep the fight going with the cavalry analogy. But it really is, you know, you got to know your role and be an expert at it. And, it was kind of hard, initially, you know, when you and I did our first tours in LAR, it was LAI then, and a lot of the O-369s, just like us, we had no experience. So it was everybody's first tour.
Everybody learning.
But the guys that did learn, that loved it, those guys are worth their weight in gold, and they stayed. And you can, you know, I had staff sergeants, they were to recover any vehicle in any situation, and do it quickly, efficiently, and even under fire, and get all those Marines out of harm's way.
Okay, give me a company logistic lesson.
That's a good one.
Yeah, thanks.
that's why you're the master. No, for me, I'll go back to, I think we talked about, training the companies to be able to do, forward, refueling for helicopters. And you get the, Marines that were trained and the company guys that were trained to do, you know, the helicopter support stuff, because we were getting a lot of supplies, you know, we could get a lot of supplies, you know, if we're that far forward, you know, from air, you know, from 53s coming in and from that. So you really, it's not just, anticipating your needs and ordering it from the battalion combat trains and battalion field trains to have it available, you know, kind of the one tactical bound behind the company so you can quickly move into action. But it's also, what can you do to be able to get logistics from multiple sources?
Right.
And if you don't think about it and train it, you won't be able to do it in on the go in the fight. So it's really, you know, that puts at the ounce of prevention worth a pound of cure. That's probably a stupid phrase, but you know, you gotta think about it and understand. I mean, we used to spend time airlifting, you know, or doing the heavy lift from 53s. You know, what if you got to get on the other side of this mountain range and all the passes are blocked? Well, we got to be able to lift the damn LAVs over and have the helicopter sit us down, and we'll drive on the other side and fight our way, you know, through the other way, you know, and just things like that, the inherent mobility and maneuverability of those vehicles. They're not tanks, and they're certainly not grunts mecked up in Amtrak's, but there's a, if you use those platforms efficiently and effectively, they really do give the commanders a lot of flexibility.
And as you said earlier in the discussion, oftentimes speed is a form of security. And you look at, I mean, you go back and you read guys who were great cavalrymen, they knew that, and they went fast, and they, you know, and when they'd strike, the first reaction was, they can't be there. Oh, yes, they can. In fact, not only can they be, they are here. And so speed is its own form of security. What about, talk about at the battalion level, Duff, a lesson, a command and control lesson learned, then a logistics lesson learned.
Command and control lesson learned. I was blessed. Mac had a great battalion XO, a guy named Mike Botkin, retired as a colonel. He had done multiple tours, LAVs and with the grunts on the East Coast. And that guy, I never once had to, even think about positioning of the field trains. I've used that term a couple times, but it is no kidding, the heavy junk and the big trucks and the main fuel and the welding, wagon and all sorts of things that go along with that. That guy always had that in position, and RCT5 would kind of husband those together. But we would have to be able to extract the things we need to get up. And then you had kind of an intermediate, logistics node called the combat trains. So the battalion combat trains carried the stuff that we knew the companies were going to need to draw first, and then the company, the combat trains would have their logistics variants and the recovery vehicle, mostly with company gunny. To me, the hardest thing, and we never got a chance to really practice it a lot, at the battalion level, companies did a lot, so, is to do the service station refuel on the move. Set that up tactically at night, and you can move an entire company and battalion through, get refueled, refed, rearmed, and you're back out on the mission without going into an operational pause. And when you can do that kind of stuff, it really, it takes the logistics guys and the Marines, the truck drivers, understanding the mission as well as the literally as well as the vehicle commanders of the LAV 25s. Because if they're not in the right place, right time, ain't nothing gonna happen right. Just the enormity and the complexity of all that, and for my XO and Sergeant Major to be able to kind of once again visualize what was happening and where they needed to be and just anticipate and just always have the right situational awareness and understanding and to be able to anticipate to get things going. Really, it was flawless from my perspective. I with my vehicles are always up with the OPSO and the fires vehicle and our wingman. The four of our vehicles are always together and we're up kind of by the lead company. But all this other stuff, the real no kidding, stubby pencil, hard work, supervision, is going on behind us. I don't think I can do it justice, but to describe it, but if you can't do that right, you're in a hurt locker. And so I was blessed with Byron Harper. I mentioned him was my op. So he could write my intent better than I could speak it. Now, I'm sorry. I apologize to your listeners. They understand exactly what I mean now, but, Byron and I could hear the exact same thing over the radio or in person, and we could talk, and he would, hey boss, this is what we're gonna do. Roger, change this to that, small dog to puppy. Okay, great, Byron. and he had it and, could disseminate it, and we could, then go to where we needed to be. To supervise, what we need to. But I just, that kind of thing, I knew that if I got shot in the head, the battalion, either one of them could take over the battalion and I would not be missed at all. And that was, I think more credit to them than me training them or anything, but just the way that, we operated. You had to have that level of confidence and understanding and almost, you know, nonverbal communication. You're like, okay, this is what we need to do. And literally 9 times out of 10, it was exactly, you know, when we compare notes, it was exactly what I was thinking. So that really helped a lot, for me. And one thing, I think my four company commanders that were there, all of them are now colonels. All of them have gotten command, you know, at the regimental level. One of my, the guy's going to be CO of 8 to 9. So I think I was blessed with superstar performers. So that's my last lesson learned, is always surround yourself with good people. And then get the hell out of their way.
They'll
make you look good.
They'll make you look good. What about when you look at, obviously, the guys who led that division are guys that are, you know, as we're doing this, one of them's in Singapore, about to walk into a room with the President of the United States and Mr. Kim from North Korea. Another one is the Secretary of Defense. Another one is the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Another one went on to be Commandant of the Marine Corps. There a lot of all-stars, in the 1st Marine Division at that time. What, as you reflect back on that, what made it go? What was it, simply the quality, the unique quality of the individuals that you guys had there, them doing their jobs, their ability to that they studied their whole lives to do, honestly. When you reflect on it, what made it go?
That's a great question, Mac, and I've never, you know, I don't reflect on anything because it makes me a hitter. But no, you're right. You know, those were the next level leaders, but the other battalion commanders there, I mean, in our regiment, all three, you know, 1-3, 2-3, or gosh, 1-5, 2-5, and 3-5 were all 3-star generals now. You know, Luke Caporata in 1st Marines, 3-star general. I mean, just the, I attribute it to, and like, you know, you and I were talking about earlier in this, I'd never been to combat. I don't think any of them had ever been to sustained combat.
Right.
I mean, there were guys in the first Gulf War that when they were in the fight, that's about as high intensity as you can get. But you know, as we discussed, overall, it wasn't the sustained, you know, and make no mistake, any listener, you know, I'm not comparing to what we did with Vietnam or anything else, but I tell you, we wound up, you know, General Krulak had a thing, you know, where he came up with this operational maneuver from the sea, and you had to have this triad of expeditionary things to be able to go that far inland and that fast to the objective. Well, you know, we did all of that with what we came to the dance with. You know, with Amtraks and tanks and LAVs and trucks and, you know, towed howitzers. And, you know, we, you know, no Marine units ever attached across land that far, that fast, you know, hopefully they never will have to again. But it was, I think, everybody that was there had studied their whole life, all those leaders to be in that position. And I want to say, the Marine Corps probably had a deeper bench, of guys that you could have gotten rid of all those that I just mentioned, including myself, and the guys who were alternates on the command list probably could have done the exact same thing. And I don't know what it is about the Marine Corps that produces that, level of quality in that quantity, you know, where literally you could go 2 or 3 or 4 down your depth chart and be, you know, an All-American, just kind of like Alabama. Yeah, football for you there, Mac, so you can understand.
Stop it.
You know,
why did you have to do that? No, but if you, I mean, you on that staff, you have, you know, you have General Mattis is the CG, now Secretary of Defense. General Kelly is his deputy. The regimental commanders are Joe Dunford, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, John Toulin, who will go ahead, who will wind up as the head of MAR-4 PAC, as a lieutenant general and retired, I don't know, maybe a year ago. And who's 7th Marines, Doc?
Lieutenant General Hummer. Steve Hummer.
Yeah, Lieutenant General Steve Hummer. And then, then you have a whole series of guys right now that are major generals. You have Paul Kennedy, who's a planner. You have Dave Furness, who's about to take over 2nd Marine Division, who's a planner. You have Lou Cry, as you mentioned, Lou Craparata, who's now going to become MAR-4 PAC. And so these guys, I mean, they were just they're all in the 1st Marine Division, and just amazing. Amazing guys. What haven't I been smart enough to ask you in terms of the things that you would learn, and if you looked at people and said, hey, look, if you're going to study the march up, and if you don't have, you know, these one, two, or three things as lessons coming out of it, then you didn't really study it. What would that be?
I tell you, Mac, I found myself drawing a lot on that experience. When I was CO of 3rd Marines and deployed to Afghanistan, you know, we kind of had the idea that it was a well-developed, mature theater. It was much more like OIF-1 when we got there in 2008 than anything else. And I found myself kind of combing back through memory of, oh my God, the fluid situation, the uncertainty, the risk that you were assuming, and all of those things. If you go back to map number one and you see the red, enemy symbols laid out there, you know, how many enemy divisions were in the one mess zone? And, we're attacking with one division into that, and use General Mass's, General Conway's words, it's going to be the most air centric Marine fight in history, and I still don't know what the hell all those guys did, but I know that the shaping and the kinetic actions that were happening, MEP and MAR-4 and theater level had the effect where we were able to only face what we could overwhelm. They were never able to mass or adjust. Once we got the speed going, they could never, to me, I don't know if Iraqi Army back then, understood the OODA loop, but I felt that no matter what we did, it was coming at them too fast, too hard. They could not adjust to what was coming at them. And we were inside their OODA loop. I don't compare what we did to the, fight for Hue City or Quezon or any of the Vietnam stuff. It was, we faced what was there and we overwhelmed it. I think had we been gooned up and were slow and methodical and couldn't find your ass with both hands and not effective and not lethal, it could have been, I'm sure we would have, succeeded eventually, but it would have been a much heavier cost, I think, casualty wise, had we not. Just look at the few times there were the blue on blues. There were great potential for a lot more of us in that dynamic of an environment to have gotten killed by the enemy or by each other than actually happened. So I think the ability to operate in that chaos, if you know what you're doing and you really focus on that and you do it well, it can overcome a lot of that uncertainty and friction.
Okay, let me ask you.
I'll stop talking.
No. What? A final question. How do you prepare for that in peacetime, in garrison? Because we all know we go to the field and we're doing stuff, blah 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 blah. But in the Marine Corps, you spend a lot of your time in garrison doing other stuff. And I don't know what the breakdown is, but what are the things, how do inspections, how do formations, how do field day, as you look back on getting ready to go and the way we exist as Marines on a daily basis, how do those things factor into getting ready to go?
Mac, that's always been a challenge. I've heard the words come out of my mouth multiple times is we can't afford to have a garrison mindset in the rear and then a field mindset in the field. We have to have the same mindset the entire time. So you have to use the chain of command. It does me no good to be a battalion commander going down there and being the best vehicle commander in the battalion. That's not my freaking job. You know, I've got to, you know, use those, the mission type orders in garrison, the trust tactics. And then, you know, you do need to supervise and train, but you know, the NCOs need to have their freedom to set their own standards. And if they understood what they were doing for the vehicle inspection, why the hell would I have to, I have to go out there and see the results of the inspection, but I don't need to be the primary inspector. That sergeant, that platoon commander, that company commander have to be the ones that are doing that. So everybody's crystal clear on what that standard is within that unit, and you have to trust them. And it's like, what do you need from me to do your job better? Because, I always saw guys, and I tried to avoid it myself, Mac, of, I thought I was the best rifle platoon commander in the Marine Corps. When I was a company commander, I'd never been a company commander before. I'm going to spend all my time learning how to be a company commander. I'm not going to slip back into my comfort zone.
Right.
And then when I was, battalion commander, I'm not going to do the company commander's job for him. I'm not going to go, sink back to where it's comfortable. And we all worked for those guys that were very attention to detail oriented to the point where they're dictating what you're going to have in your ass pack, and everybody in the regiment's going to have six, empty, sandbags those kind of things. I'm like, to me, that's too heavy handed and it creates this artificial, it's almost a mother may I type mindset in garrison that doesn't work in the field in combat. And so it's hard to try to, create that and sustain that and not get too heavy handed or too, overly micromanaging of people. Cause I'm like, hey man, if we're out there on a 50 kilometer screen line, I can't micromanage you. And if I can't freaking trust you, I need to fire you right now because I need to know that you're going to be able to do your job. And if you're out there, you got an enemy coming at you and you don't know what's going on, but you got to execute your mission. So it's hard to do that. And I'm grasping for, concrete examples, but it's kind of that.
The way you are in the field is the way you're going to be in garrison. And so you've still got to issue mission orders. You've got to have coordinated instructions. You got to let them do their thing and then you got to inspect them. And that's the way we do it. But you can't be two different. You can't have two different command styles. It's got to be the same. And that way you're learning in garrison, you're learning in the field, and it's just one continuum that you're getting better and better the more reps you're getting. So you've got to be consistent and you've got to be the same.
I think so, Mac. And that's nothing original and people are like, wow, White's a genius. But I mean, that's the way we were taught. I'm a believer. I've seen it work.
Right.
That's my advice.
All right. Well, first of all, Duffy, this is taking us a couple of days to do, but just want to thank you for giving your time. And, the picture you paint You know, we were talking earlier in this, in that, you know, the march up, you know, you see the flat yellow terrain, and you see, you know, you see roads, and you see these, you know, arcing blue arrows. You don't realize the labor, the effort, the supervision, the, you know, turn around and go back. All right, now we're gonna switch lanes, and we're headed this direction. You know, all that takes incredible effort to do it, and literally in contact with the enemy, right? And try not to kill each other, and or try not to get killed as you're, you know, by your own aviation as they're doing their thing. And what did Clausewitz say in war? The simplest things are difficult, and the difficult things are impossible. But those things all get done by leadership, and by, you know, by grabbing things and stuffing them through. And so it's the reality of this beautiful arcing march up is the painstaking leadership of Marines in combat. And there's nothing like it. If you've ever seen it, it's probably one of the coolest things you've ever seen in your life. The courage, the selflessness that you see Marines, and also the Ashjuan leadership, guys taking charge and getting shit done in an organization that doesn't accept second place. Pretty amazing to watch. Pretty amazing to watch. And I've said it takes your breath away. Duff, can you put into words the courage, the selflessness, the effort, the leadership, and the grit that you saw during the march up?
It is hard, and it was, you know, certainly wasn't the fight for Iwo Jima, but it was every Marine had that in them, and it really did bring the circumstances. I think everybody kind of rose to that level, and the level that they needed to be at and to operate, and there was no time for anything else. And especially as you, the more it got on, you know, the more time that went by, and the closer we were getting, you know, the more tired you were, the more, you know, just, you know, reaching the point of physical exhaustion, mental exhaustion. But that's when you probably had to be the sharpest, because, you know, as we discussed, that's when, you know, the closer you get to trapping the enemy, that's when they're the most dangerous. So, I always felt that, that the division was, you know, the most effective, efficient, you know, machine. And it was still tempered with the judgment that General Mattis wanted us to have. And you see in that letter that you posted, Mac, of, we don't want to go in here and blow up a whole village. We don't want to blow up anything unless they're trying to fight us. And then we're going to kill those guys. And we're going to kill them very quickly. We're going to set an example. So it was the kind of the muscular restraint, of being absolutely ready to destroy whatever you needed to, but that was it. And we didn't want to create, and we didn't want to operate in a way that we were going to create resentment as we were liberating these people. And we certainly didn't want to win the war and then lose the peace, because of our own actions. You know, and I think that's the way we kind of, from the leadership, at least that we had in the Marine Corps side all the way down, we were trying to do those kind of things. And I tell you, there were so many, individual actions that were recognized with significant combat, awards. And every one of them, I think were well justified, you know?
All right. Duff, again, my guest on this battlefield study of the march up and the role that the first light armored reconnaissance played, the Highlanders. Highlander 6 has been our guest. He retired as a full bird colonel after he led the 3rd Marine Regiment in Afghanistan. He led the 1st Light Armored Reconnaissance Battalion in the March up, and an incredible career. Duff, first of all, thanks for taking the time out and helping me do this. I truly appreciate it.
Hey, Mac, it was a great time for myself. If I could, I sent you an email earlier that's got the link to the first LAR Battalion Association.
Yep.
We're standing that up. We want the Highlanders to have a home for the rest of their lives. Once you're in the tribe, you're always in the tribe. And we're for those listeners out there, we're trying to build a memorial there at the Battalion CP to memorialize the men that paid the ultimate price for the combat there in the Gulf War, and then, you know, OIF and OEF. And, you know, take a look at it, take a look at the link, and take care of your brothers, and go ahead and join. You'll be glad you did. The older you get, the more you look back on this. You know, it's been 15 years, Matt. You know,
wow.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, you know what? I just went to the dedication of the 5th Marines Vietnam War Memorial, and it's been 50 years. 50 years since Hue, since Tet, and some of the incredible things that the 5th Marine Regiment did in Hue City and the other fighting that they did. And, you know, to me, it's the epitome of what Semper Fidelis means. You know, what does that term mean? Well, I think these are good examples of, you know, 50 years later to raise $400,000 to put every Marine and sailor who died while fighting under the battle colors of the 5th Marine Regiment memorialized in granite forever. That is Semper Fidelis. That is what we teach. That is the Marine Corps. And Marines, even out of the Marine Corps, at their finest. And you guys are going down that same path. And so the link is in the interview. So and it's easy to find. You'll see it. And so go ahead and click on that and join and help them do what Marines do, which is never forget. So Duff, good on you guys for doing that. Good on you guys for doing that. And I know. I know Mike Musselman, we did a show on it not too long ago, and so had a pretty good time doing that. So so thanks for bringing that up.
All right, Mac. Hey, enjoyed it.
All right. That'll do it. More of Almarine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.